Good evening. Governor Cuomo orders his pause for New York State to extend to May 15th. The Army struggles with an outbreak among trainees, while advocates demand youth, immigrants, women, and the aged be released from prison. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with some of the news for Thursday, April 16th, 2020. The Trump administration has made public what they call a phased approach to reopening the United States economy, struggling against the global pandemic caused by the new coronavirus. The new guidelines are aimed at clearing the way for an easing of restrictions in areas with low transmission of the virus while keeping them in place in harder hit locations. The recommendations make clear that the return to normalcy will be far longer process than Trump initially envisioned, with federal officials warning that some social distancing measures may need to remain in place through the end of the year to prevent a new outbreak. Under the federal guidelines, those most susceptible to the respiratory disease would be advised to remain sheltered in place until their area enters the final phase. The economic costs were clear in new federal data showing that at least 22 million Americans have been thrown out of work in the last month. Dr. Deborah Birx, the White House Coronavirus Task Force Coordinator, added that data from across the country showed the nation improving, but that Americans had to recommit to social distancing to keep up the positive momentum. Nine states have fewer than 1,000 cases and just a few dozen new cases per day. But even GOP leaders say that any reopening of the economy should be cautious. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican close to Trump, said the lack of widespread testing was an impediment to lifting the social distancing guidelines. He said, "We are struggling with testing at a large scale." Meanwhile, in New York, the state at the epicenter of the outbreak, Governor Andrew Cuomo extended stay-at-home restrictions Thursday through mid-May as New York City is getting ready to use 11,000 empty hotel rooms for coronavirus quarantines.
The New York pause policies, the close-down policies, will be extended in coordination with other states to May 15th. I don't want to project beyond that period. That's about 1 month. 1 month is a long time. People need certainty and clarity so they can plan. I need a coordinated action plan with the other states. So 1 month, we'll continue the close down policies. What happens after then? I don't know. We will see depending on what the data shows. What does that mean? Tell me what our infection rate spread is. Is it 0.9? Is it 1? Is it 0.7? Tell me what the hospitalization rate is. And then the experts will tell us the best course of conduct based on that data. No political decisions, no emotional decisions, data and science. We're talking about human lives here.
The governor also doubled down on his order requiring all state residents to wear masks in public where social distancing guidelines can't be maintained. That includes all public transportation, ride shares, and taxis, among other places. Cuomo admitted that the order was unpopular, but he maintains it's a small price to pay for flattening the curve.
I know there's a lot of opposition to this. I've had many people say they don't like it. So, no, I'm fully aware of the opposition to wearing a mask. It's a face covering, right? Just so we're all saying the same thing. It's a mask or a cloth covering of the nose and mouth. It doesn't have to be a mask. It could also be a cloth covering. But no, I understand that people do not like it. And people understand, some people do not like it. And some people think it is an imposition. And it is a government overreach. I understand that. By the way, some people think the close down order was a government overreach. Some people think that this is all a fabrication and a political conspiracy. To them, I say, if you don't think 600 people died yesterday, and if you don't think that's a problem, I disagree with you. If you doubt that 600 people died, I'll bring you to see the 600 people. So is it a fabrication? No, 600 people died yesterday, okay? And that's a reality we deal with every day. We want to see fewer people die. I'm asking New Yorkers to wear a mask. Not just to protect yourself, but to protect other people from you. If you have the virus, you can infect other people. And you have a liability, a responsibility not to infect me because you're sick. And that's what a mask would help. I understand the opposition. My phone's ringing off the hook with the opposition. I also understand what 600 deaths mean. I understand the toll on the healthcare system. I understand the nurses and the doctors who are stretched to their limits. I understand the police officers who go out there every day and who are afraid.
He added the mask requirement would be necessary for anyone over 2 years of age. Cuomo said Thursday that virus transmission rates still need to be tamed as he prolonged the rules that have left many New Yorkers working from home and unable to gather in public since March 22nd. He had some good news. The hospitalization rate in the state was down. Total number of people in the hospital was also stabilizing, although he says it's hard to say if the curve of increasing infections by the virus has been flattened yet. But he also says intensive care unit admissions are down, as are intubations, a procedure used in the most critical patients. But Cuomo also said there's a steady 2,000 new cases a day, a reduction in the rate of increase, but still a large number. The governor made a lighthearted introduction to his toll of grim-sounding statistics. He referred to a TV show from the 1960s where the catchphrase was, "Just the facts, ma'am."
My man, Sergeant Joe Friday, just the facts, ma'am. My daughters say nobody understands who Joe Friday is. That's their mistake. Dragnet was an underappreciated cinematic treasure, in my opinion. Joe Friday, just the facts, just the facts.
Sergeant Joe Friday, played by actor Jack Webb, was a Los Angeles cop known for a no-nonsense manner.
Ladies and gentlemen, the story you are about to see is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
In fact, Friday never used the exact words attributed to him. In more COVID-19 news, an Army training battalion at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, had a cluster of 50 positive COVID-19 cases, according to senior leaders. Army Chief of Staff General James McConville says the cluster hasn't grown, adding the service plans to begin taking in new recruits for basic combat training next week, following a 14-day pause that started April 6th. General McConville laid out the situation with the Army earlier today.
We've had 992 soldiers from all three components test positive for the COVID-19 virus. And as of this morning, we have 14 out of our 15 urban augmentation medical task forces employed. Six are distributed throughout New York City hospitals and the Javis Center. And as of last night, Javis had over 300 COVID patients and has seen more than 840 patients to date. Three are assigned to New Jersey. One to operate either Convention Expo Center in Edison, one will provide augmentation at the Newark Hospital, and one will arrive later this weekend to support Atlantic City. We have one in Stamford, Connecticut, operating out of the Bennett Medical Center, and we have two task forces in Massachusetts, both to support the Boston area. One is on the ground, and the second medical task force arrives this weekend to begin integration. We have a team in Detroit, Michigan, at the TCF Center, and one moving today to Joint Base McGuire-Dix-Lakehurst will provide support to East Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. We have one remaining medical task force prepared, ready to go to support. The two field hospitals that were supporting Seattle have completed their mission and will be on a 48-hour prepare-to-deploy orders for follow-on COVID-19 support. Yesterday, I visited Fort Jackson with the Sergeant Major, and we personally walked through the new measures in place for our trainees. I want to ensure the parents and families of soldiers that even in this time of uncertainty, one thing remains true. We have a sacred obligation to take care of your sons and daughters, ensure they are ready to support and defend this nation, and we have the right measures in place to do that. And to our adversaries that wish us harm, do not be mistaken. The United States Army stands ready to defeat any threat, just like we'll defeat this virus.
The Army has continued to take in new recruits during the ongoing pandemic, but the number of intakes has been roughly halved. McConnell says the Army has the ability to test 750 people a day, but added there's a shortage of chemicals necessary to read the tests. But even as the Army admits a shortage of some testing materials, the big business of the military-industrial complex continues. The military is actually sped up payments to contractors since April 1st and has pushed for defense contractors to be listed as essential services. The Pentagon has said it wants business as usual to continue even as the pandemic ravages the world. In March, the Pentagon released a deviation of progress payments memo, increasing the rate that companies are paid from 80% to 90%, ensuring a cash lifeline to the contractors. The web editor for In These Times, a progressive publication based in Chicago, is Sarah Lazar. She says weapons manufacturers are being rescued while the economy drowns.
Much of the global economy grinds to a halt. The U.S. war machine keeps humming and whirring. The military-industrial complex is being thrown a life raft while the rest of us drown. There are a few ways that this is happening. The Navy is accelerating contract awards for the explicit purpose of protecting cash flow. The Department of Defense released what it calls a deviation on progress payments memo, which decrees that progress payments for contracts will essentially be higher. And they also say this is aimed at financial support for the defense industry. This was widely cheered by some of the most horrible weapons manufacturers of our time, like Lockheed Martin. We are also seeing that the Department of Defense declared the defense industrial base to be essential work during the COVID-19 crisis. That means people who are building tanks, who are building drones, who are building tankers and warships are still showing up to work. I spoke with someone who worked for a contractor of Lockheed Martin, and he has continued showing up to work even though someone at his job site was diagnosed with COVID-19, and he said that he's very concerned because he's not able to do proper distancing at his workplace. And then there's one other way that we've seen the defense industry get bailed out, and that's in the $2 trillion CARES stimulus package. Included within that was $17 billion for a federal loan program for businesses deemed, quote, critical to maintaining national security. While Boeing is not explicitly named, it was the $17 billion program was crafted, quote, largely for the company's benefit, according to the Washington Post, which cites two sources.
As of today, the small business loans have run out, $350 billion. The last one was given this afternoon. There's no more money for that program to save small businesses, yet money is going to these large businesses.
Militarism is a default position of our society that at a time so many people are suffering, you know, we now know that more than 20 million people have filed for unemployment in the past several weeks, that it's the companies that are making bombs and lethal weapons that are getting this kind of financial support. When it's that military apparatus that's actually making the world a more dangerous place. U.S. weapons are primarily fueling the lethal bomb attack on Yemen by the U.S.-Saudi coalition. Those bombings have continued during the pandemic, even though now we know that there's a COVID-19, at least one COVID-19 case in Yemen. At the same time, the U.S. is cutting off aid. All of these things make the rest of the world far more vulnerable to a horrible outbreak. When any place in the world is more vulnerable, the whole world is more vulnerable because it's a global pandemic. So we're actually giving a financial life raft to the industry that is making the world a more dangerous place in the middle of the pandemic.
Sarah Lazar is web editor for In These Times. Protection measures against the coronavirus continue to tear through the employment ranks, with 5.25 million more Americans filing first-time claims for unemployment insurance last week. That brings the crisis to just over 22 million, nearly wiping out all the job gains since the Great Recession. But besides the unemployment, small business owners are hurting too. On Thursday morning, the $349 billion emergency small business lending program officially tapped out. The Small Business Administration officially ran out of money for the Paycheck Protection Program, according to a message for lenders posted on the administration's website. Negotiations on Capitol Hill have yet to generate a path forward to replenish the money, all as the U.S. economy continues to stagger under the pressure of near nationwide closures. On a news conference call yesterday, New York Democrat Representative Nydia Velazquez says she's partnering with GOP Senator Marco Rubio from Florida to come up with more cash for the program.
In addition to fighting for $185 billion more for PPP, including $65 billion to be set aside for community financial institutions, I am proposing an additional $50 billion for EIDL, or the Disaster Loan Program, and $15 billion in additional grant funds. This is the way that we can assure that minority and underserved communities have a real opportunity to access capital. And we must see the demographic and economic data on who these loans and grants are going to, so we can make improvements. This is something that I have asked the SBA to release. I spoke to Secretary Mnuchin last week and this week, and I'm insisting that there is transparency in the program, that we get the data that we need in order to make judgment as to how well the program is working and if the program, the PPP, is working as it was intended by Congress. So whether you have already secured federal aid for your business or you are currently trying to navigate the process, I want you to know that my staff and I have put out a series of fact sheets and resources on the PPP loans and other available options, including economic injury, disaster loan, and grants. And you can find these materials on our website, smallbusiness.house.gov.
Richard Hunt, president of the Consumer Bankers Association, says lenders would need roughly $1 trillion to satisfy demand for PPP loans. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell asked for unanimous consent to pass a clean $250 billion infusion of funding for the Small Business Lending Program, but Senate Democrats objected, citing the need for hospitals and state and local government to also receive more money. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said Thursday during her weekly call with reporters that negotiations continue, reiterating Democratic demands for adding that additional funding for state and local governments and hospitals. Meanwhile, millions of small business owners face an uncertain future. And you're listening to news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Today, the Justice Roadmap held the People's Briefing to report on the pandemic behind bars in New York State. They cited that they are what they say are glaring omissions from the governor's daily press briefings of updates or action related to New Yorkers incarcerated in jails, prisons, juvenile detention centers, and immigration detention in the state and in New Jersey as well. Among those most endangered from the virus are those in immigration jails.
I'm McCray. I'm with the Brooklyn Defender Services as part of the New York Immigrant Family Unity Project. We are the first in the country assigned counsel program for people who are detained and facing deportation. We represent people who are detained at primarily at four county jails in the New York City area. Three of those jails are located in New Jersey. Those are in Hudson, Essex, and Bergen counties. And one of them is located in Orange County in Goshen, New York, in the Hudson Valley. What we're hearing from our clients who are detained in these facilities is very alarming and really echoes what a lot of the other speakers today have been describing about the conditions in other New York State and local jails. That jail, although it's not currently reporting any positive cases, what we're hearing about the conditions in the jails is very concerning, because it just is very clear that that jail is not observing a lot of the best practices and advice of public health officials that we've all been told to follow. Slow or dismissive responses to calls for medical attention and requests for medical attention, and just a complete lack of clear testing criteria as to whether and when anyone would be tested.
We have Derek Kane, the Director of Client Services at the Brooklyn Community Bail Fund.
From 2015 to 2019, the Brooklyn Community Bail Fund has paid bail for nearly 5,000 people from pretrial detention. Immigration jails in New York and New Jersey have reported to be both toxic and underprepared for this moment, thus making immigration detention facilities fertile places for the spread of COVID-19. ICE has a long history, as we all know, of medical neglect. Even before COVID-19, people were dying in immigration detention facilities, children included. Since mid-March, we've bonded out over 40 people, double the usual amount that we generally do, thanks to emergency fundraising. This includes a lot of people with underlying conditions, people who needed to care for their loved ones. We recently paid bond to free a fellow New Yorker who just got out just in time to see his father, who is dying on a ventilator, as it relates to COVID-19. perspective. We've recently paid bond up to $25,000 for a single person. $25,000. How is ICE expecting families to pay that, especially now given the current status? No one should ever have to pay a ransom to get out, but especially not now in the middle of a public health crisis.
Up next is Jennifer Connor from Justice for Migrant Families, Western New York.
Everything has changed under COVID. A month ago, a young man with asthma repeatedly asked to be given refill for his inhaler. And for 2 weeks, the pharmacy in Batavia was out of his medication. After 2 weeks, he had a severe respiratory attack and was rushed to the emergency room, where he was finally given an inhaler. That same person is being denied release right now. He's also experiencing difficulty breathing, fever, and he is being denied access to medical call. And in his words, he said, "I am a human being. They are letting me die here. What would happen if I die? No one would know." And one name that really we should be talking about, at least in terms of Batavia immigrant detention, is the Buffalo DHS field office director, Thomas Feely. He has the power to respond in a more responsible way to this disaster and to release people on humanitarian parole.
Next up, we have Reverend Ruben Austria from the founding executive director of Community Connections for Youth.
What we're seeing happening in juvenile detention, many of the same things that are happening in the adult facilities. Young people's educational program is being interrupted, and they're no longer having access to school, maybe getting some packets of work dropped off. All of the other types of things that help kind of just keep young people occupied, sports, positive youth development programming, all of those things have been suspended under the assumption that that's going to help stop the spread of the virus. We've had trouble getting just even connected back to young people in facilities. Thankfully, we've been able to stay connected to their parents. But what we're hearing from parents is the parents are scared. The parents are worried. The parents are not getting updates on their kids. And you hear some of these kids being made out to be these hardened criminals. And we're talking to parents who are saying, "I finally was able to speak to my son. And he said, 'Mommy, I'm scared I'm going to get sick and die.'" And so we're talking about kids who are under 18, who are children.
Up next is Bianca Tylik, founder and executive director of Worth Rises.
We're an organization that specifically works to dismantle the prison industry and end the exploitation of people who are incarcerated and their families. It has been absolutely reprehensible what Governor Cuomo has been doing in the use and utility of prison labor, and in many ways mocking prison labor. There are those people that are making the hand sanitizer, this life-saving hand sanitizer that is being distributed across the state, is being made inside of our prisons. And in those prisons, only until recently, only until we fought and we challenged the docs, did we actually get them to even hand out hand sanitizer to all the facilities. And we are hearing that that implementation is not consistent, and that there are still many people within the prison facilities that do not have access to that hand sanitizer. But it's important to note that this is not new behavior for Governor Cuomo. This is something that's been going on for a very long time. The state has been using prison labor for many really challenging things, including asbestos abatement, to just regular functions of the DMV, call centers, all for just cents an hour is what people are paid. But in many times where there is an emergency or a calls for an emergency response, people who are incarcerated are the ones who are tapped.
And New York State has thousands of prisoners reaching old age in prison, a population also threatened by the virus.
Our first speaker is Jose Saldana, the director of the Release Aging People from Prison campaign.
There's one thing that really troubles me. It troubles a lot of us with Governor Cuomo. Not only does he ignore the plight of incarcerated people across New York State in 52 prisons, he's actually ignored the fact that the fatalities from this pandemic virus is mostly people of color. And that's something that he has to address. It exposes a double standard of health care. And he's not addressing that because he doesn't consider us to be his constituents. People of color, people incarcerated, the majority of those incarcerated are people of color. Our families are supposed to be constituents of his, but he doesn't value our constituency. This is why he can go on and ignore the moral obligation that he has to address this issue in a humanitarian way. And I think this here questions the type of leader that he really is. The Department of Correction has already failed us. They failed us miserably. They shut down the visits. For 52 prisons were shut down the visits, and they did not provide masks for the correction officers. What kind of sense does that really make? The only way this virus can now enter the prison is through correction staff, and they did not provide masks and gloves for them. The stories that I'm hearing from those who are incarcerated, they are afraid to come out their cells. People are coughing, they're sick, all night coughing. People are visibly flu-like symptoms all up and down the company, and people are actually afraid that they will eventually get this virus. This is in every prison that I'm in contact with.
And those are voices from today's Justice Roadmap held by the People's Brief, which held the People's Briefing to report on the pandemic behind bars in New York State. And that's some of the news for Thursday, April 16th, 2020. The news was produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.